Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rates and Lanes with your hosts, Rico Muhammad and Chuck Snow.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Rates and Lanes podcast. I'm your host, Rico Muhammad. We will be joined shortly by my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow. And our special resident legal expert, Mr. Hank Seaton, will be on with us tonight. So I suggest if you have legal questions or if you would just like to ask a question, you go ahead and press the number one. That puts you in the screener's queue for us to be able to come to you to get you up and on board to ask your question. We always welcome your participation and your interaction with the show. But with that being said, we're going to start off as we normally always do, and that's going to be looking at this week's trend lines report from DAT. And we're showing that this week we have 0.4% drop on diesel fuel price. So really not much of a change on diesel fuel price nationwide. We're showing a national average of diesel fuel at $2.39 per gallon. Demand for trucks fell last week compared to the spike that we saw over the previous 2 weeks. Inventory for this week's e-commerce sales were already in the pipeline, so load posts on DAT1 load board networks fail. Truckload rates continue to be elevated across each segment type. Taking a look around the country to see how those rates were performing for each segment type, starting off with dry vans. I get my technology to cooperate with me. Starting out in the northeastern portion of the United States, we're showing an outbound spot market rate of 207. Moving down to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we're showing an outbound spot market rate of 226. Moving up into the Midwest, we're showing an outbound spot market rate at 263. Coming back to the south central region of the United States, we're showing an outbound spot market rate of 226. And coming out of the West Coast for dry vans, wrapping up, showing an outbound spot market rate of 258. Moving on, jumping over to the flatbed segment of this report, we are showing that the outbound spot market rate coming out of the Northeast is at 220. Moving down to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we're showing an outbound rate for flatbeds on the spot market at 261. Moving up to the Midwest, we're showing an outbound rate for flatbeds at 268. Moving down to the south central region, we're showing an outbound spot market rate for at 232 for flatbeds. And wrapping up, coming out of the West Coast, we're showing an outbound spot market rate for $2.19. And moving over to the temperature-controlled or reefer portion of this report, we're showing an outbound spot market rate starting out in the Northeast at 226. Moving down to the South and Mid-Atlantic states, we're showing an outbound spot market rate on average at 221. Moving up into the Midwest, a very strong outbound spot market rate averaged at 299. Moving down to the South Central region, we're showing outbound spot market rates at 238, and wrapping up, coming out of the West Coast, showing outbound spot market rates at 268. And with that being said, without any further ado, let me go ahead and welcome my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow, in for the evening. Chuck, how are you?
We're doing well. How are you, Rico?
Oh, man, I couldn't stand it if it got any better.
I do want, you know, tonight, I just want to say something. I don't usually advertise or anything, but if any of our listeners have extra power, especially dry vans in Southern California, I got a call tonight from one of our offices in the U.S., and they're drowning in freight out of San Bernardino, Fontana, Rancho Cucamonga, and Schaffner. That's all in the, I call it the L.A. basin. I'm sure that people that live in LA are just cringing when they hear that. But if you have anything down there in equipment, give me a call. and I'll set you up with our office that's looking for some power, and I'll give my phone number out after the show. But other than that, everything is pretty balanced. We're busy, and I like what I'm seeing. I don't know how long all of this is going to keep up. I hope it stays up, but quite often this is the big push right now. We're getting towards Halloween and U.S. Thanksgiving and, you know, all the Christmas stuff going into the supply chain. Hopefully it keeps up after, and we don't have to, you know, like the edge of a cliff. We've seen that lots of times, haven't we, Rico?
Absolutely, absolutely. And with that being said, don't want to keep our special guests waiting as well. We love it when we have them on. Always a wealth of knowledge, very spirited conversation. And with that being said, we want to welcome our resident legal expert, Mr. Hank Seaton. Good evening, Hank. How are you?
Good evening, Rico. How are you doing, Chuck? Good to talk to
We're
you.
Doing well, buddy. Thanks for joining
doing
us.
Doing great. Doing great. So, Hank, I know that you all always come with us with some interesting things that are coming down the pipeline. And I don't want to waste time. What are some things that are kind of on the radar right now that we need to be aware of?
Well, in a way, I think a lot of people are kind of waiting for the next shoe to drop, and the next shoe is obviously going to be the election on November 3rd and the outcome of that. Chuck, you don't have to deal with all of that right now, but
we do, though. You
in
know
the
what?
U.S., it's pretty much a turmoil.
Well, you know what? I got to tell you guys something. I'm up in Canada, and Canadian elections don't hold nearly the element of participation, spirited participation from Canadians, and I mean in dialogue and arguing and in time spent watching candidates. Canadian politics are so boring. We love your elections. This one is no different. It's certainly, the talk at every dinner table. Yesterday was Canadian Thanksgiving, and most of us, unfortunately, had to tone it down and reduce the number of people that were allowed to join us at the Thanksgiving dinner table. But probably about 99% of the families in Canada, the topic at the Thanksgiving dinner table was your election. So don't undermine our interest
well,
in your politics.
I think the last thing you had, Chuck, is anything like this is when Quebec tried to leave the Commonwealth.
Yep. I would think, yeah, that's probably – and you know what? They only stayed by – it was a 1% difference. It was 49 to 51. They barely stayed, and I'm certainly very glad that they did. I think it was a good decision for everybody. But I do need to ask both of you something, and it's something that has come up an awful lot of times lately in talking to friends and family. To what degree – in reality, does the U.S. president control the economy? Because my view on it is a lot of the economy is cycles. And, you know, sometimes you just hit the end of a cycle and you change administration. Now, I realize the president can make some tax law. But other than that, how much push does the U.S. president actually have on how good or how bad the economy is?
Well, you know, when you come from the English system in which the parliament can oust the government, you have a whole different format than what we have. I think the scary portion about this election is there are so many economic issues floating around. Usually it's not that polarized. And with that lead in, I'll talk about the two things that are kind of immediate for the listeners, and in fact something that needs to be done in the next 10 days. The independent contractor model, as most people know, has been under great challenge. There is a bill in both the House and the Senate that would do away with independent contractor treatment of owner-operators. If we have a complete flip in both the legislative and the administrative session, I think the concern is that the independent contractor model, as we know it in trucking, could be veto-proof and skip. Obviously, we already are fighting the battles on the state level, but I think by and large, that's the sleeper argument that is a dirty little secret most people don't want to talk about, but certainly carriers with independent contractor fleets and owner-operators should be very wary of that possibility. It goes without saying that the owner-operator model is kind of an apprenticeship for running your own trucking company, and it's a way for an entrepreneur to get his feet wet and then grow into a safety program. So I think it would not only affect those people who are small carriers, but also a large percentage of the new applicants. So I think it would have an anti-competitive effect because it would take away the tax benefits if it gets to the point that everybody has to be paid a wage an hour. It would stifle productivity and ambition. In that regard, there are a couple of things that are coming up. Put down October 16th, which is the date that comments are due to an ATRI study. It's ATRI. It stands for the American Transportation Research Institute. The website is truckingresearch.org. This is a poll that's sponsored by the American Trucking Association. The due date for filling out a questionnaire is a mere 3 days away, but ATA uses this to propose what they call a roadmap to the course of industry to speak with a collective voice on important issues. That being the case and the fact that this study will be touted as what's going on in trucking, it's probably important that small carriers be heard. There are about 12 issues that are listed. Some of them are, frankly, kind of beyond our reach, like telemetrics and things like that, things that we really don't have any control over. I'd like to see the small carriers that represent the vast majority of regulated carriers take a few minutes, fill that out, and I put out a newsletter that goes into a little more detail I'll be happy to give to you, but of the issues that are listed, I think the independent contractor status, the use of safety to create problems for small carriers, which is compliance, safety, and accountability and insurance availability, should be in a small carrier's top 10. So I urge listeners, if you want to have to be counted in yet another poll, this is like the mail-ins to vote. It's going to be very easy, and it's just really a head count. So your count will count as much as a large carrier if you fill it out. The second issue we have, as most people may know, we're just not governed by one federal agency. We're governed by multiple ones. You've got to answer the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, which is a division of DOT on safety. You have to answer to the NLRB in terms of application of employment law, the STB or the Small Business Administration has a play as well. And then ultimately, if you're an independent businessman, you got to file your own taxes. And at that point, it really makes a difference whether you're a wage earner with withholding taxes and workman's comp payments to make, or whether you're an independent businessman. Now, all of those issues are kind of coming to the forefront. There is a Department of Labor notice on the street. They would propose, even in a Republican administration, that there be a one-size-fits-all test to determine whether you're an independent contractor. And that test would basically say, Are you controlled by working for a single person? And it's a test that, if applied in trucking, doesn't really realize the exceptional nature of what we do. So we're thinking about filing comments in that proceeding to stress the fact that the independent contractor model is a choice, not enforced servitude, and that business entrepreneurs don't have to be large. They need an equal chance to compete. And that's something that, you know, I think small carriers really haven't lobbied in on. And the large carriers have kept it a secret. But if we're going to get a carve out in a new political landscape, we need to start building attention for it. So those are the two top political issues that I see that in the coming month, and then we'll all sit around on November 3rd and figure out what happens the next day.
Now, I got to ask you something. So can we just drill down a little bit for the benefit of some of our listeners? When you're talking about this change in legislation, that does not affect the small carriers like Rico, for example, that runs a couple of trucks, as compared to the a friend of ours that's been on the show a number of times, Angela, who is leased on with Landstar, and she gets her dispatch from some Landstar office that she works with. They're trying to really take her business model out of the box, correct? They're not going to affect Rico what he does, are they? Because he's a carrier.
Rico as a carrier, as long as he is the only guy who drives the truck and he doesn't add owner operators, would probably be exempt from reclassification because he would be in his own trade or business.
Right.
If an argument could be made, if 90% of Rico's business was on a dedicated operation to a major broker, that major broker would have to consider him to be an employee, which would be unfortunate.
But even though
Rico has his own authority,
right,
and you would think is free from control. For example, in California with AB 5, the guys who are serving both Uber and their competitor, and who may work part time and have a good degree of freedom, are being reclassified as employees. I really don't think that this issue is one that affects guys who have made the migration and are in their own business with respect to their tax returns. It does affect,
right,
Angela and the 800,000 small business men who use the independent contractor model to buy a truck, learn the trucking industry, and then migrate into becoming their own businessmen. I've asked the people at NASDIQ if they can tell from their NEST course. I haven't ever really seen any data on how many people who enter trucking with one or two trucks have actually cut their teeth by being independent contractors. My guess is it's probably a very large percentage.
Oh, yeah. From the people that I've met, and Rico and I met there actually at Kevin Rutherford's boot camp in Kansas City. That's where Rico and I met and became instant friends. I would say, Rico, back me up on this or correct me, but I would say probably close to 95% at least were leased on with companies as owner-operators, using that company's insurance and authority, and then migrated on to getting their own. Is that correct, Rico?
I'm sorry, my audio cut out for just a second. What
happened? Would you say 95% of the people we met at the in Kansas City at Kevin Rutherford's boot camp for truckers were people that had started out as owner-operators leased on with a company and then migrated it into getting their own authority and insurance.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you see, that's the point that needs to be made, and I'd love to have anybody that's on the line who will let me take a little statement to that effect. Let it be known, because you know the independent contractor model is one real opportunity for blue collar entrepreneurship. And
yes,
you know, you'd be kind of foolish to say, well, gee, I can drive a truck, I need to go and get my own authority, because an owner operator gets halfway home just in the process. They understand the financing of the truck, they quickly begin to learn what freight is desirable, what freight isn't. They develop the skills. They don't get into it unless they're ambitious. Heck, if they want to work by the hour and get benefits, they can get plenty of jobs truck driving. It takes special breed of cat. And, you know, it's not surprising to me that in this day there are large numbers of people who come to America for the very purpose of starting as an owner-operator, starting their own business. Not everybody who comes in has to start a sandwich shop. The independent contractor model, is really a choice, not involuntary servitude. But the whole thrust of the legislation is that an independent businessman doesn't know what he needs. He needs the government to tell him, and it's all tied in with how you manage your assets and how you classify your earnings. And, the economic load that would be put on the model if an independent contractor is treated as an employee is really pretty incalculable, because let's face it, there are a whole lot of tax benefits that an independent contractor gets. And,
but they're taking
so
a lot of risk at the same time,
The part of the argument that is telling, and what we're writing is, look, for 30 years at least, I think it's for 40 years, in trucking there has been a carve-out for an independent contractor, because it's known that because of federal regulations, they have to control you. But that control doesn't contaminate the relationship. The success of the relationship and what the IRS and the NLRB is traditionally recognizes just that an independent contractor is an entrepreneurial type who has the chance to make it or to lose it. And that independence, that ability to take the loads you want to take, reject the ones you don't, manage a piece of equipment to have skin in the game, are all exceptions to the old issue of involuntary servitude, where people try to say, well, you're a coal miner, but I'm going to bill you for your axe. You know, there is a car out here. And there has to be.
You know? Yeah.
Well, but the issue really is, in the trucking industry, for 40 years there's been this thing called the Truth in Leasing Regulations,
right,
that says that if the carrier isn't treating you right, if he isn't being candid, if he isn't keeping it between the mustard and the mayonnaise, you can go to federal court. So, you know, there have been protections built into the model. Plus, 100%. I don't know of any other industry that is so heavily dependent on independent contractors than over-the-road trucking, dray operations, and fresh fruit and vegetables.
Yeah, no, that part's true. But, you know, I do want to volunteer my services. If you ever need me to speak at a hearing in Washington on this subject as a witness, I would gladly do it. Hopefully I don't get deported for it, because I got to give them a piece of my mind. But right away, the biggest problem, if you outlaw this independent contractor thing, is how the heck are you ever going to move the fresh fruits and vegetables in the United States? You know, people are going to starve, because the vast majority of fruits and vegetables are hauled by independent trucks. There are only a very small handful of large companies in the United States with reefers that are hauling fresh fruits and vegetables. They don't touch it as a rule.
Well, Chuck, you just volunteered, buddy. We need, we're going to submit. I'm trying to get our coalition together that includes shippers and brokers and other people to explain that, you know, we should be an exception to the rule, not only because of the value of the independent contractor model to the small business, but just simply the economic dependence. The other thing that we've done going forward is, if you're operating from a stationary location in California, then you know, you may not have a whole lot of opportunity, and the inconsistency between California and Tennessee law may not bother you. But when you're talking about interstate commerce, there ought to be one federal rule that everybody complies with. If you get one rule from Massachusetts, another one for Tennessee, and then the NLRB and the FMCSA can't agree, how in the world is a small businessman supposed to comply with the different laws in 48 states and four different laws for the federal government? The system just comes crashing down.
Geez, Hank, I'm having a little bit of deja vu here. I'm kind of remembering what trucking was like back in 1974, when there were different length laws and different weight laws and all sorts of craziness throughout America. And people in our industry worked really hard to deregulate and re-regulate and have one law fits all for interstate commerce. And what do we want to do now, 40-odd years later? Do we really want to go backwards? Like, come on. This is craziness. You know, and
well,
we have some
of
this
federal government. The role of the federal government should be to set rules of commerce that are fair and equitable and apply to everybody, not to micromanage businessmen or stifle competition in the name of unionization. May I use that dirty word? Or the idea that everyone needs to be paid not to work? You know, that's kind of the antithesis of what an entrepreneur wants to do.
Right. And you know what? There are, in all fairness, there are those people that want to they want to work in a union environment, and they do very well in it, and that suits their lifestyle. I am nothing against them, but they don't want to take the chance and put their skin in the game and invest their money in a truck and be gone from their family for days and sometimes weeks and risk it all. And other people are willing to do that. And I think, and this is a Canadian speaking, but isn't the great American way risk versus reward, where you're supposed to put your neck out there, and if you don't get it chopped off, you do okay. And if you get it chopped off, you go back to the line. Isn't that how it all
works?
Well,
it's supposed to be the land of opportunity, where it doesn't matter what your pedigree is or how much farmland your parents own, that, you know, you can work hard and buy one truck and end up being J.B. Hunt. I mean, that's the whole motivation for people that have an entrepreneurial spent. That's not to say that people shouldn't get a gold watch and be praised for going to work 40 hours a week and supporting a family and choosing that as an alternative. You know, when they give the award to at the NASDAQ conventions for the guys that have 10,000 or 10 million miles without an accident, it don't matter whether that guy's an owner, operator, or a company employee. He's to be lauded
right.
for doing the same job.
yeah, it's all about safety. You're right. And I think that that's a decision that shouldn't be legislated. I don't want the government to tell me that I can only work so many hours. Isn't that why people come to places like United States and Canada, because of freedom? Otherwise, we'd go to Cuba or Russia.
Yeah, and, you know, there are some people that fit very well to be on a dedicated run as an employee. There are other people that love those dedicated runs because they get home every night and they do it with an owner-operator truck. So, I mean, it's in trucking, you have a great diversity of job opportunities. I mean, you know, if you sign on with a bad company, at worst, you got 30 days to go out, and you've got 100,000 other companies that, if your driving record's clean, are looking for you. People don't have that in impoverished areas where a big plant moves out.
No. You know, trucking is one, you know, it's in some ways, it is not the coveted job that it may have been 40 odd years ago when everything was unionized, but it's still a job that is in demand. And through this whole pandemic crisis of 2020, trucking is one of the few industries that has really held its own. You know, and I'm proud to say that we're all part of it. And I hope that when there's hearings in Washington, your politicians and bureaucrats get a reminder that it was the truck drivers and and their backup support that kept the shelves full and the supply chains full and kept food in people's bellies throughout North America. Because I think these guys need another reminder.
I don't know how many people on this call are as old as I am, but my office was down at 13th and Pennsylvania back in the days when the owner-operators blocked up D.C. in a strike over something the government was trying to do. I'm not advocating that kind of militancy, but
no.
It is unfortunate that the press in our country is so prejudiced and so in the tank to make the independent contractor model into being the devil personified, that the case really isn't made by the people who can make it best, that it is a choice, and that to take it away is going to do more social harm than the alternatives.
Well,
but,
you know what? It's,
you know, there,
it's not just
it
social
may be
harm.
That we need to see. I mean, I'd be more than happy. There are probably people on the line that have different points of view. But I think on this we can disagree and say that people should have the freedom to choose to be an employee or an independent contractor. The two are not
100%.
Inconsistent, and they haven't been inconsistent since I've been doing this, and that's now running on to 50 years.
Yeah, it's it's just too bad that this. You know, we're wasting a lot of resources on silliness, as far as I'm concerned. And speaking of silliness, I read in it was in FreightWaves or Transport Topics the FMCSA. Is now going to hold hearings on broker transparency. Now, personally, and I speak for myself as well as my company, Traffics, I really don't care. I'll show any carrier, you know, how much I'm making. I'm not ashamed, but I think this is craziness that the government is talking about sticking their nose into somebody else's business. Like, what happened to free enterprise?
Well, you can't blame the FMCSA for this, really, because they wish the issue would go away. They never have had an appetite for doing anything other than regulating safety. But OIDA filed a petition, and then TIA filed a petition, and they're really two extremes. OIDA says that they want the commission disclosed on each invoice, and they're really out to, I think, almost to say, let's get it like it is in the real estate industry, where the intermediary gets a standard 6%, 8%, or 12%. TIA came back with just the opposite, saying they wanted to strike the requirements in the regulation that any party could see the transaction upon request. The real issue, and I think you'll agree to this, Chuck, is over time, particularly large brokers have gone and acted like a carrier and guaranteed rates. And when they guarantee rates, if trucks are short, they lose money. And when trucks are plentiful, they make money. So they're sitting here saying, well, look, I'm going to lose money at times, so when I can, I'm going to get all the margin I can. Well, all that does is it feeds into instability for small truckers. And you see what, for some person's point of view, may be gouging because the broker is making 40 or 50%, whatever the traffic will bear. But from the broker's point of view, he's just playing the market. It's arbitrage. And, you know, that leads to real instability. And from my point of view, the real important thing is let's not lose the fact that a broker should receive the money in trust and pass that money on down to the carrier, because that hit the commission's his to keep. The margin is his to keep. Just like in a real estate transaction, or me as a lawyer, I want to ultimately, if he goes out of business, say, where's my money?
If you
robbed Peter to pay Paul, or you had a trucking venture over here you're losing your shirt in, that didn't give you the right to take the money the broker gave you intending to pass on to me and spend it.
100%.
That is the real issue. I've got to travel out to Sacramento to depose some flaky folks sooner or later that, as best I can tell, ran off with $6 million, never had a broker's license, and can't account for the spread.
Ooh.
And as you can imagine, this is, it happens in that particular industry every 6 or 8 years. And the idea, it's anti-competitive. You know, if somebody has to rely upon the credit worthiness of traffics to do business with you, they're going to immediately say, well, gee, he's a Canadian and I have never heard of him before. You know, a broker shouldn't have to want to see your financial statement to know that you're trustworthy and you're going to, pay them when you get paid. I don't have the biggest law firm in town, and nobody asks me for, if I collect money for them, whether I'm going to transmit it to them. It's a breach of ethics not to.
You may not have the biggest law firm in town. You got the best. One of the things, though, that in defense of all this is, number one, if you compare freight brokerage to real estate brokerage, there's a lot of differences here. And one of the big differences is when you have real estate agents that are out there selling, they all work on commission. It's strictly commission. And I can tell you on when it comes to hiring sales talent in the logistics business, you pay commission, but you also pay huge salaries. And I mean big salaries in some areas. And I think that a lot of times, if you're going to peg some of these brokers to a limit of 15% or whatever they're talking about, or having to even, some of them, I would imagine, having to show what they make, they have to make that much, at maybe 16 or 18%, in order to pay these expensive salespeople they have. That's number one. Number two, what's happening, which people don't realize, is when you go to a big company, whether it's Pepsi-Cola or Kraft Foods or whoever, they will give you a lane. And they will give you a lane at a set dollar. And you win because a lot of the business is done on RFQs, request for quotation, and you sign a contract. And you have to move those loads that you're given at, let's say, $1.97 a mile from point A to point B. And, yeah, if you're dealing with carriers sometimes that are running the spot market, sometimes they're winning, sometimes they're losing. And as Rico and I keep coming back to this, if the boys and girls out there stop playing the stock market and just work from point A to point B, none of this really will work. They don't have to worry about it. It puts an end to the problem because now all of a sudden they won't be underpaid and they won't be overpaid. They'll be fairly paid.
There's another component to the shipper mentality that I've seen over a period of time. 15 or 20 years ago, there were actual traffic departments that developed relationships with asset-based carriers, and the RFQs you were talking about usually weren't severely price-driven. They were, I get somebody who can provide me with service and is within a range of reality, and I've done my job. But starting about 20 years ago, outfits like Covisint came out and the reverse auctions came in.
Right.
And then the big money started getting into it. The big brokers who said, well, you know, we're big enough to support this. Let's go in and offer this guy gain share. We'll save you money. We'll take over your distribution system, and we'll pay you half the money we save. Well, once they got the contract, they went to the incumbents and said, look, we're the new sheriff in town. To get access to your traditional freight, you're going to have to sign up with us and take a 15% haircut, or we'll go find somebody for whom you're a backhaul. And that is actually a situation I have seen over and over and over again. I've got a good friend and client who's got 22 trucks, and he served the same customer for 40 years, and the 3-year bid cycle was over. He was assured that your service is impeccable, and then was cut out in the bid process. And I have had meetings with people on the shipper side, and it's become procurement law. There is no loyalty, and if you put all your eggs in one basket thinking that Mr. Shipper is going to be loyal, you miss the cram down.
Yeah.
And
you're 100% right. I can't argue with that. Listen, I've seen it where a shipper's given us an agreement to start hauling for them, and we hired extra owner-operators, and they were giving the freight to our competitor and never had the intention of really giving us the work. It happens.
Let me ask you this.
Contracts. Go ahead. Go ahead, Hank.
No, it's called a most favored nation clause. A lot of these dudes put in the contract that you promise you won't give any comparable freight, haul any comparable freight for anybody else any lower than their rate. And if they can find somebody who'll haul it cheaper, you got to meet that rate within 10 days or your 3-year contract is out the window. Now, what does that do to your risk assessment? You know, you're going to sit here and go buy a shiny new fleet to get a 10-day notice when all of a sudden somebody figures out they got a lot of a backhaul freight out of St. Louis. It really isn't a situation in which their logistics partnerships, particularly not really strong ones, when the traffic department has to deal with 100 small carriers. They There's no.
They don't want to. You know, that's where that's where the load brokers have come in, the logistics companies, and they've taken that function away from a lot of those manufacturers. And some of us do a great job and do things fairly, and there's some that, you know, that work very unfairly. I've got to ask you a question, though, as a lawyer. How many contracts have you seen between carriers and shippers that are real steel-clad contracts that the carrier has to abide by and the shipper has to abide by? In all your years of practicing law, how many have you seen?
Well, you know, I constantly see, I wrote a book about this in 2003, and I put in there the Dirty Dozen, 12 provisions that I typically saw in shippers' contracts that were decidedly unfair. 17 years later, that number's gone up to about 20. And what I have to tell carriers is, you're hung by and large with what you sign. When deregulation hit, the idea of there being rules of commerce that were fair and equitable to everybody went out the window with what they call a 14101B waiver, which is a guy gives you a contract, usually now on MRIS or mycontracts.com or whatever, and he says in the spot market, Bubba, if you need to get home, you'll sign this contract. If you don't, go take a hike. Well, people sign these damn things. So then when the grocery house says you're 15 minutes late and we don't want the product, go dump it. You know, it's a risk they've assumed. When all of a sudden, nobody wants to inspect the product or find out whether it's fit. They just wanted it dumped, and you sign a contract that said you'd waive duty to mitigate and salvage, and you don't have insurance for it. What am I to do, saying I'll pray over your funeral? I mean, you know, what I've got to tell people is, look, I'll try to find whatever after-the-fact defense I can. I'll try to shame them into the fact that what they're doing is not fair, but your issue goes all the way back up the chain to the contract you signed.
Right.
I'm going to read. You just opened the door for me to read something. I've come out with a contract addendum page that I think people could attach to every contract that would very quickly precipitate what's in that 15-page contract. Because, you know, nobody has the time to read the contract. Small people don't. Here's what it says. This addendum shall supersede or modify any term and condition of contract between the parties. Number one, general principles of federal transportation law, regulations, and the terms and conditions of the standard bill of lading shall apply to all shipments. What you do with that phrase is you say the rules of the road that just simply apply will trump whatever's in this damn contract. Now, what you get out of that is you get claims adjustment that, for cargo claims that's consistent with the insurance you got. You don't get any kind of aha about reject it, crush it, and dump it. You get things like the broker regulations, which say that the guy will receive the money in trust. You get things like the bill of lading, which says that you're not required to deliver a shipment by any particular time, but with reasonable dispatch only. So you write back into the contract what you can insure and what you can reasonably be expected to do. Now, there'll be a lot of shippers who'll read that and say, ain't no way, buddy. I'm not going to agree to general principles of federal transportation law. I want much more from you. And at that point, you say, what do you want? And very quickly, you get into, does he want to impose a greater risk on you than you can insure? Does he really want special or consequential damages? I've got a case that I'm working now where the people are saying that they want my client to accept liability if the goods, which are in a sealed container, won't be processed through the manufacturer's machines without breaking down the machines. So I'm asking the question, now look, my guy's just transporting your boxes from A to B. He don't know what the hell's in the boxes, and you're telling me that if you send the wrong computer-coded material and the plant shuts down, you want me to pay for it? Now, those kinds of things, you know, you got to, it's silliness, okay?
But, Hank, I got to ask you something. All these problems, do they not usually raise their ugly head when somebody is stuck in Odessa, Texas, and they've been there for 5 days without a backhaul, and they really need to get back to Pennsylvania, and they get desperate, and they do stupid stuff to get home out of desperation? Isn't this where everything happens?
No, I think it's SOP for the spot market. I think that that kind of stuff, it's, you know, if it's stupid stuff to go somewhere you don't have a backhaul for, then you're really stupid. But I guess the question that I have got is for someone like you, Chuck, don't promise your shipper more than you can deliver by being fair with the carrier. Increasingly, what I'm seeing is brokers are going out here and accepting rejected, crush it, dump it, accepting guaranteed deliveries, accepting offsets for late deliveries, accepting shipments that don't pay detention. And then what they've done when they've accepted obligations that are unreasonable, they've got, all they can do is try to cram it down on the little guy. Now, I've had them tell me when I've gotten upstream for little guys who've been beat around for a weekend with a rejected load in Houston because the plant closed earlier and some broker was yelling at him on Tuesday morning, you will deliver that load, you're holding it hijacked, and he's been run around without pay for a week. I went to the big broker, happened to know the lawyer, and he says, oh, hell, Hank, we put a margin in here. He says, this shipper's hard to serve. What's it going to take to make it fair to your guy? Now, you know, I'm just saying that a lot of these big guys have a bigger risk appetite because they know they're going to pay for some loads. But they got a volume of freight to hide it. For a little guy who doesn't have anything but reefer breakdown, $100,000 load that is denied by his insurance company, he's going to put him flat out of business.
That's right. I agree. And, you know, it's not good for anyone. And that's why I think that the smaller carriers, you know, the guy with one truck or two trucks is probably best at the end of the day to just work between point A and point B 52 weeks of the year. Don't get greedy. Right now, things are going crazy. People are offering crazy amounts of money in certain lanes. I think overall, the small carriers and even the large ones, I think people are best to just set out and do what they do and don't get carried off. The grass is not really greener on the other side of the fence. It just looks that way because of the way the sun's shining on it. And,
well,
you know, that's what happens all
this.
The time.
You know, the guy, I don't want to get contrarian about the independent contractor model, but knowing what I know about the uninsurable cargo risk and what I know about insurance costs for little guys makes me wonder if a percent of the revenue as an owner operator isn't a less risky business. I mean, I can see a cargo claim putting a small guy out of business. Where 100%. If the same thing happens, the loss is borne by the carrier, and I can see, you know, I've got a client now that is liquidating his company and going to be a fleet operator for somebody else, And it's all over insurance.
Yes.
It's all over stinking insurance. He's going to surrender his, go back to being a fleet operator for another carrier, all over that insurance rate, because that insurance rate is almost equal to the percentage margin he'll haircut he'll take working for the other guy.
Yeah. If you know, that's a real problem, and I think you just had it last week with the new nuclear verdict, and I forget how much the number was, but it was insane.
I think it was $114 million.
Yeah, like, come on, it's insanity. Like, come on, people, are they trying to stop every small trucking company in the United States, other than 20 big ones that are involved in a captive or they're self-insured? Like, this is insane. But this goes back to greedy lawyers and of course crazy juries.
Whoa! Oh, that feedback is.
We all right?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm fine. But yeah, it's just,
well, no. I mean, I'm a consultant on a case in which some poor bastard ran out of hours, so he parked on the side of the highway, 4 feet inside some bicyclist at 3:00 p.m. ran into the back of the parked truck. He
right.
wasn't even looking at the highway. He was looking down, had no reason. But somehow he managed to get some severe injuries. And, the insurance company is already calculating that it's not something they can defend.
So what happened
wow.
then? The carrier has to take it on the chops?
Well, what I say, they can't defend it. They'll most likely pony up the policy limits at some point. And
oh,
then, the plaintiff's bar, probably go after the carrier the injuries are so bad that everybody fears that unless the judge is the 13th, the juror says, well, you know, the guy, just tough shit for the guy. he was responsible for his own injury. That, you know, a jury will be sympathetic and you'll get one of those nuclear judgments. So, you know, everybody that does defense work and the insurance companies are all frightened to death of that. And that's why so many cases at which the carrier really ain't at fault ends up being policy limits. And you know what happens when it goes to policy limits and you've got one of those substandard insurers, they cancel you. Won't rewrite you, and all of a sudden you're a dead man walking when it comes to insurance time.
You liquidate at the time truck. I just got the notification. So we are at a point where we want to let everyone know how to get in touch with Hank, and you can get in contact with Hank or go check out his website over at www.transportationlaw.net. That's correct,
and,
.net, right?
Yeah, that's right. And if anybody is interested or willing in filling out the ATRI study, or I've already got Chuck and hopefully Rico convinced that they'll help us with affidavits in support of the independent contractor model, you can get my name and address off that. I'll be happy to help you. And Rico, do you get a copy of our monthly regulatory update? If you don't, I'm happy to send it to you, and you can put it on your website. And, you know, I'd be happy for any of your listeners to take a look at it. It's pretty straightforward analysis of what's going on. I know you get a lot of people trying to sell you stuff, and if you're following freight waves or those people, you're getting a lot of good current stuff. But this would give you one thing to look at a month that would pretty well summarize the mischief that's going on in Washington and around the world.
Yeah, I just want forget that. I think it came out last week. I think I seen it last week when it came through.
Yeah. Well, that's got some of the things about tonight on it.
Absolutely. Chuck, before we get out of here, before the time runs out, tell the people how they can get in contact with you, and we'll land this puppy.
Okay. Give me a call if anybody needs me or wants to get set up with Tropics, for especially for any of these California loads, at extension 203, which is real important. And the phone number is 800-388-4352. Or reach me at Chuck, C-H-U-C-K, at Tropics.com. And you can catch me on Instagram with a private message at Chuck Snow, CEO.
And with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, you could have been anywhere else in the world, but you took a little time to hang out with us, and we definitely appreciate it. God willing, we'll talk at you same time, same place next week. God bless you. Good night. Keep it in between the mustard and the mayonnaise. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Catch you on the flip-flop. God bless. Thanks, guys.